as a small stack of papers, a thumb drive, and what Koichev recognized as an Iridium GPS tracking device. There was a cover letter of sorts, typed in Russian, and signed by a fellow Avtoriet, a brigadier in the organization. The letter was indirect, making references to events and people that only the reader would understand. It was an effective, if informal, code. No computer or word sleuth could decipher it. The message was simple. Locate the target, identify his vehicles, and develop a pattern of life. This was to be acted upon with the highest urgency, as the request was coming from the big boss himself. It didn't take a man of Koichev's experience to determine that someone's days were numbered. He pulled an inexpensive laptop from his desk, one that he never connected to the internet, and slid the thumb drive into the USB port. The first file was a series of photos of a man, both in and out of uniform. Koichev recognized him from the media coverage, a former SEAL who had gone on a rampage after the deaths of his wife and daughter, becoming the most wanted man in America. Other files contained satellite imagery, maps, bank account records, and other fragments of data that would help find and eliminate the target. Koichev closed his eyes and thought about the problem at hand. His people were accustomed to operating in cities where they could hide among the masses of humanity. Putting men, particularly foreigners, into such a remote part of the United States would attract immediate attention. He had an idea. He typed "Whitefish Montana bartender jobs" into Google and found two current openings. One of those jobs would work perfectly. He called his most reliable female employee into his back office, taking a moment to admire her before giving her his instructions.
"Tanya, you are moving to Montana."
Chapter 18. Whitefish, Montana. Tanya was not pleased when Sergei sent her on this assignment, but she'd quickly fallen for the natural beauty and easy pace of the small resort town. Ski towns across the American West were often staffed by Eastern Europeans during the summer months, and Tanya befriended a group from Bulgaria and Serbia. Within 2 weeks of her arrival, she'd moved into a crowded house where she shared a bedroom with Elitsa from the city of Sofia in the Balkans. She mostly worked nights, pouring drinks at a local bar and flirting with the fly fishing guides, their wealthy clients, and seasonal residents of this idyllic community. Most mornings, she could be found sitting on a bench on Central Avenue, sipping from a to-go cup of coffee. Just another young girl in yoga pants, scrolling away on her iPhone or reading a magazine, taking in the warm sun and clean mountain air. Her bench just happened to give her a perfect view of anyone going into or coming out of Flathead Bank and Trust across the street. Tanya was worried that she wouldn't be able to identify the man that she'd been asked to locate. From the photos, he looked similar to a decent percentage of the men in town, late 30s, tall, probably bearded. She began to typecast the men she observed, each of them falling into one of a few molds. Mustached cowboy locals, scruffy fishing guides, pudgy summer tourists, or obviously wealthy Californians with property nearby. None of them had the hardened look of a combat veteran. It was late morning and she was about to give up for the day. She'd offered to work a double and needed to shower before opening for the lunch crowd. She started to walk up the sidewalk toward her home a few blocks away, when she saw a Toyota Land Cruiser turn down Central. The off-road SUV looked to be of an older vintage but was in like-new condition and tricked out with an aggressive bumper, lights, and a roof rack.
"Interesting."
She leaned against a light pole and pulled her phone back out of her pocket. The driver was the correct height, about 6 feet tall, and had broad shoulders and thick arms. He wore jeans, a t-shirt, and hiking boots, and looked like he might fit in with the guide crowd. A ball cap and sunglasses shielded much of his face, and a dark beard masked what was left. The black glasses looked different from the typical fishing shades so popular in town, but it was his demeanor that gave him away. While nearly everyone else she saw walked with a carefree attitude or had their face buried in their phones, this man's vigilance set him apart. His head moved constantly as he took in his surroundings before locking the door of his truck. He reminded her of a fitter version of some of Koichov's men who sometimes passed through Brighton Beach, hard and serious. He disappeared into the bank and she went back to her bench. She opened her camera app and prepared to frame a photograph while looking like she was mindlessly shopping or checking a social media platform. She sat with her knees to her chest to steady the shot, and when he emerged from the bank, she took a burst of photos followed by a video. He opened the back hatch of his SUV and retrieved what looked like a case for a musical instrument, which he carried two storefronts down into a place called Glacier Archery. Tanya sent a text message with the video and photos to Koichov in New York, then rose from the bench to prepare for the lunch shift. Chapter 19. Whitefish, Montana. Reese didn't have an exact routine, but he would head to town at least once a week. He would hit the bank, the post office, the archery shop, and the bookstore. He had become a bit of a regular at Lula's and would often stop in for a late breakfast or lunch during his forays into civilization. One of the waitresses, with an accent he'd narrowed down to somewhere in the Balkans, had a crush on him. She always commented on how polite he was. Despite her best efforts, though, he hadn't asked her out. When he walked through the door of the cafe, Tanya knew that she had about 30 minutes until he would be done eating. Maybe longer if Elitsa was extra chatty. She waited impatiently before making her move, just in case he'd left his wallet or phone in the truck and came out to retrieve it. After an agonizing few moments, she crossed the street with what to anyone but the closest observer appeared to be a black cell phone in her hand. She knelt next to his right rear tire as if to tie her shoe and reached as far under the vehicle as she could. Her view was blocked by the running boards, but they would also prevent anyone from spotting her handiwork without physically crawling under the SUV. She twisted her shoulder and knelt further to slide the device over the top of the frame rail and felt the tactile click of the powerful magnet as it took hold on the steel. Brushing the dried dust and dirt from her hand on her pants leg, she rose and continued her walk as casually as possible. Halfway around the globe, Oliver Gray remotely activated the GPS tracking device on his desktop terminal and waited several seconds before the software triangulated the transponder's location. The image on his screen blurred and then settled on the northwestern United States, the pixelated image clarifying as it zoomed into the town of Whitefish, Montana. A blinking red indicator signaled the location of the Iridium GPS tracking device from James Reese's vehicle. The software program overlaid the vehicle's location on existing satellite imagery from Google Earth, providing real-time location data. After what seemed like an eternity, the dot began to move, slowly at first and then more rapidly as the vehicle left the confines of the small town and reached the highway. The dot slowed several miles out of town and turned onto an unpaved road. After winding through timber and open meadows, gaining altitude as it progressed along its path, the dot stopped at the edge of a large lake and made no other movement for the remainder of the day. Gray scrutinized all of the available imagery of the location, and it was clear that there was a cabin or house there. Gray reached into his desk drawer, removed a bottle of vodka and a glass, and poured himself a shot. Raising a drink to the dot on his screen, he smiled. He'd found the son of his first betrayal and current tormentor of his dreams. Montana is where they would strike. Chapter 20. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. "I don't see him," Reese said, scanning across the valley with his Swarovski range-finding binoculars. Rafe held his older Zeiss binos to his eyes, his hands cupped across the brim of his ball cap, to stabilize the 10-power image. See the rocky face to the left of the pines? Giant pile of rocks? Check. Come down 100 meters, and you'll see some smaller boulders with a clump of green brush in front of it. See it? I see the brush. See his tines? No. Wait, I see him, Rhys said, with excitement in his voice as his brain separated the deer's velvet-covered antlers from their nearly identical surroundings. He's huge! He's a good one. Let's put the scope on him. Rafe let his binoculars fall to his side on their long leather strap and began unstrapping a tripod and spotting scope from the outside of his Stone Glacier internal frame pack. He and Rhys had hiked up the ridge before dawn, hoping to catch the wise old buck out feeding before he snuck back into the safety of his bedding. The morning air was cool and steam rose from both men's bodies after the tough vertical climb. They knelt just below the ridgeline opposite the mule deer, glassing him from a safe distance across the canyon. Rafe had been watching the buck all summer, and when the opening day of archery season came on the 1st of September, he would make this same journey with his primitive recurve bow. He efficiently set up the spotting scope, quickly locating the animal through the heavily magnified glass. The slightest touch of the spotter or tripod would knock the 60-power image from its target, so he carefully backed away from the scope without disturbing it, motioning for Rhys to take a look. Though the deer was more than 800 yards away, Rhys could see every detail through the optic. The sun was just beginning to break over the tops of the tall pines, bathing the buck in shadowless light that a photographer would kill for. He probably weighed 300 pounds, and his thick body was dwarfed only by the size of his headgear. The summer had been a wet one, even by local standards, and his antlers had grown to their full capacity thanks to the lush mountain grasses. He would rub off the velvet soon, exposing the hard, bone-like tangle beneath. The rack was as thick as a man's wrists at each base and spanned out nearly 3 feet. Each side of the buck's antlers held 4 points plus a smaller brow tine, making it a 4-point in Western parlance. Its forks were deep, its points long. The deer was a living symbol of Rafe's family's conservation efforts. He was old and healthy. He had evaded the bullet and arrow season after season, learning the habits of those who pursued him. Rafe would hunt him alone, on foot, with a weapon that had existed for 10 millennia. If one of a million little things didn't go wrong during the stalk, where the buck had nearly every advantage, Rafe would put a handmade spruce arrow through his lungs. The meat would sustain the Hastings family during the brutal Montana winter and provide an all-natural source of nutrition for Annika and her baby. God willing, their child would one day hunt one of the many sons or grandsons that this buck had sired. The cycle would continue, just as it had since the first hunters roamed the earth. "How old is he?" Rhys asked, breaking the silence. 8, maybe 10. He has the face of a really old buck, an effendi sheds from last season. They were a bit bigger than what he's wearing now, so he's a little past his prime. He's a smart one. Look at how open the country is around him. He can sit in that spot and see anyone or anything coming up from below. If anything tries to get him from above, he'll hear it on the rocks. He has the wind in his face most of the time, and he only has to walk a few yards to feed, which he probably does at night.
What's the plan?
I'm going to come in above him. I'll do it barefoot to avoid making noise coming over the rocks. What are the winds like around here? I'll wait until the middle of the day, when the thermals will make my scent rise. I'll get as close as I possibly can and wait for him to stand. They hiked back down to the ridge to where their trucks were parked at a pace that allowed them to talk. The ranch has changed a lot since college, Rhys said.
Thanks. It's been a lot of work.
My dad did most of it while we were deployed. The land was overgrazed and overlogged when we acquired it. There was so much fuel on the ground. A fire would have been catastrophic. There's no money in getting a bunch of dead trees out, but we did it anyway. We did some careful burning and a lot of reforestation. The natural grasses are healthy, and we've thinned enough of the timber to let some vegetation grow. We are struggling a bit with the grizzlies and wolves, but that can't be helped. Overall,
Our elk herd is coming back from the winter kill a few years back, and as you can see, we have some beautiful deer.
I got to experience revitalization similar to that in Africa. When we started really hammering the poachers, the game figured it out and moved back in. I wish I could have stayed longer to see how it all turned out.
Uncle Rich has kept it up as much as he can. Dad and Thorn actually started a foundation stateside to help keep up the fight. They wouldn't be where they are now without you starting it up and showing them how effective anti-poaching operations could be with the help of some modern targeting and intelligence practices.
That's one of the ways the agency found me. Well, that's what you get for showing off. When is your girlfriend coming out?
She's not my girlfriend. She's... It sure is funny to watch you get all flustered whenever her name comes up.
If she can get away from work, she'll be here Labor Day weekend.
If we're lucky, we'll have the back strap from this buck for dinner during a visit.
I'm sure she'll be impressed.
Chapter 21. St. Petersburg, Russia. Gray studied Reese's habits like a chess player would a worthy opponent. He would only get one chance. Once the element of surprise was lost, the hunter would become the hunted. Gray had no intention of becoming Reese's prey. His strategy would be to lull Reese into the complacency of his tranquil surroundings and then strike fast and hard. He had built an initial plan, and it was time to present it to Zharkov. His boss had been patient with him, but there was very little in it for the organization. He wouldn't approve using his resources for a reckless venture. The elder Zharkov wanted Gray's attention back on running counterintelligence operations for the Bratva. Gray gathered his files and put everything into a manila folder. After shutting down his computer and locking it in the safe, he slipped on his custom jacket, the fit of the fabric giving him a physical confidence he'd lacked for most of his life. He opened the door of his office and stood in the doorway. Svetlana swiveled in her chair and faced him head on.
"How do I look, Svetlana?" "Oh, you look so wonderful, Oliver."
She was immediately at arm's length, fretting over him. She straightened his already straight tie, brushed a piece of lint from his lapel, and ran her hand across his bearded chin.
"You are ready, Oliver. You have worked so hard for this. Go show the Pakhan how smart you are."
Oliver held his head high as he took the elevator to Zharkov's office. He was ready. Zharkov looked over the written narrative of the plan for the second time. He had to admit that it was sound. Gray had done his homework. The CIA had taught him well. Zharkov had taken a gamble by hiring him, but that wager was already paying off. He set the target package down and looked at the figure before him. Gray's transformation since their first meeting was evident. The CIA analyst had been an alcoholic mess, a loner and a filthy genius, teetering on the brink of disaster. Like a puppy from the street, Zharkov had cleaned him up, fed him, and given him a purpose. And, just like a dog, Gray had given Zharkov loyalty in return.
"This is a good plan, Oliver."
"Thank you, Pakhan. With the appropriate resources, we can eliminate the target."
"I agree. There is something missing, though."
Gray looked perplexed.
"It is a very thorough plan to kill Mr. Reese, but it says nothing about his friend Rafe Hastings."
"Why would we kill him?"
"Because I don't want him coming after us when we kill his friend."
"I see. That is going to require more resources, more people. It will complicate the plan significantly."
What Gray did not know was that Zharkov had done his own intelligence gathering. A jet belonging to Hastings's father-in-law had taken off from Nice, France, just hours after the rocket attack that killed Gray's mentor, Vasily Andrenov, in Basel, Switzerland. Andrenov had left behind a fortune. Zharkov had many associates in common with the late Russian expat and made some quiet inquiries as to whether there might be a reward for bringing to justice those responsible. Andreinov had surrounded himself with an extremely loyal group of advisors who now controlled the resources of his lucrative foundation. In exchange for killing James Reese and Rafe Hastings, Zharkov would quietly receive a 10 million euro reward. The money would go into his own pocket, and Gray, out for his own revenge, would repay Zharkov with a lifetime of gratitude.
Add Rafe Hastings to the target deck and you will have my support, Ivan declared. Kill them both.
Chapter 22. Yak River Valley, Montana. Dmitri had flown through Moscow and New York and finally into Seattle. He'd driven the breadth of Washington State, picking up the weapons in Spokane. The Sinaloa cartel's network throughout the United States was an extensive web of hubs and spokes, allowing for the efficient transportation of contraband throughout the country. Though designed to move narcotics, that same network could move anything from teenage girls to weapons, including the dozen AKM rifles that his team would use on this operation. Personally, Dmitri preferred the AK-74 he'd used during his own military service, a weapon that fired the smaller, high-velocity 5.45mm round rather than the more venerable 7.62mm Russian cartridge, for which the AKM was chambered. He loved what the little 5.45mm did to flesh. It created wounds so devastating that the Afghan Muj called it the Devil's Round. The arsenal mark indicated its Russian origin, sent no doubt to feed some insurgency in Central or South America during the 1980s. A rifle was a tool, and these tools would work fine after a good cleaning. He steered the panel van through the darkness, following the directions that had been provided to him by the local asset. Rumor had it that Tanya was a tasty thing. Maybe he'd get a chance with her at some point during this operation. She had rented a remote farm in the Yak River Valley, an extremely distant corner of Montana, known simply as the Yak. Situated only miles from the Canadian border, the Yak was the kind of place where people minded their own business, a place where gunfire wouldn't raise many eyebrows, a place where men could gather and train. He crossed over the east fork of the Yak River and saw a sign that said, Stabbin' Cabin 100. Dmitri caught the landmark, but his English missed the pun. The gravel road wound through the trees, his headlights catching the movement of small clusters of white-tailed does who rose from their beds as he steered among the thick pine trunks. The landscape finally opened up to a lakefront clearing with a cluster of structures arranged near the waterfront. There was a sprawling main house, two smaller cabins, and a large barn, plenty of room to accommodate his team and their equipment. Best of all, the closest neighbor was miles away. Dmitri backed the van up to the doors of the barn and shut off the engine. A tall man with a shaved head walked toward him, his eyes squinting in the headlights. He opened the door of the van and stepped out just as the figure reached him.
Dmitri?
Da. I'm Vitya.
The men shook hands, sizing one another up, like a pair of male lions assessing dominance. Vitya was taller and thinner than the new arrival, but looked to be close in age. Lasevsky Vitaly Vasilyevich was a St. Petersburg native who had served in the GRU, Russia's military intelligence agency, attached to a Spetsnaz commando unit. He was trained in collecting intelligence in forward areas, helping some of Russia's fiercest warriors access and exploit their targets. He had served in South Ossetia in 2008 and, after returning to civilian life, found his skills were marketable to Ivan Zharkov and the Tambov gang. He'd been sent to Brighton Beach but bounced around the United States, living primarily in Miami and Los Angeles. Unlike most of the Brotherhood, Vitya had no criminal record, so he was able to move freely on his own passport rather than one procured by Zharkov's son.
"Any trouble with the weapons?" he asked.
"No problems. Come, help me unload them."
Dmitri opened the back doors of the van and dragged one of two long Rubbermaid tubs toward the bumper, nodding for Vitya to take hold of the other end.
Each tub was loaded with a half dozen rifles that had been smuggled across the southern border. Ammunition was easier to acquire in the United States, and Vitya had bought a sizable quantity in Nevada on his way up from L.A. The men stacked the two weapons containers next to three wooden crates, stenciled with a mixture of Cyrillic and English markings. Each crate held two 700-round sealed metal spam cans of 123-grain FMJ ammunition with lacquered steel cases. The ammunition was loaded in Russia by Barnall and exported worldwide to feed the millions of AK-series rifles built during the Cold War. The guns and ammo, often carried by illiterate child soldiers, fed insurgencies, dictatorships, and drug wars, and helped keep women subjugated across the developing world, the Soviet Union's everlasting gift to humanity. Dmitri pulled a tarp over the arsenal in the unlikely event that someone might wander into their secluded training site.
"There has been a slight modification to the plan," Vitya said.
"Oh?"
"We now have two targets."
Dmitri nodded.
"We will have enough men to take out triple that."
"Let's have a vodka, friend."
Vitya motioned toward the main house. Dmitri didn't argue. It wasn't in his nature to turn down a drink. Chapter 23. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. The phone on Alexander's desk rang twice and then went silent. 30 seconds later, it rang once and then ceased. He looked at it and sighed. He was tempted to ignore it, but knew that he was not yet at that stage. He pushed himself back in his chair and marched from his private office. As deputy director of Directorate S, he didn't owe anyone an explanation of where he was going. Alexander made his way toward Gorky Park, named for writer and activist Maxim Gorky. Stopping to gaze into shop windows from time to time, he used the glass to look for tails. He doubled back twice but didn't notice any familiar faces, even ones hastily disguised with a different hat or sunglasses. Alexander missed the old park. It was so much easier to conduct business back before the vacant buildings and crime-ridden paths were transformed into clean and Wi-Fi-enabled eco-friendly family zones. The intelligence officer fished a phone from his pocket and dialed a number.
"What do you know about an American family named Hastings?"
Alexander's father did not waste time with pleasantries. It was important for him to maintain his dominance.
"Context?"
Alexander inquired curtly. It was also imperative for him to establish that this conversation was about business and not about being controlled by a domineering father, head of the Bratva or not.
"Roots in Rhodesia before the unpleasantness. Son was an American Navy SEAL, first name Rafe. They may be connected to another SEAL who interfered in the assassination attempt of the U.S. president last year, the same event that was successful against President Zubarov."
"Commander James Reese, I know the name. I look into it. Anything else?"
"Yes. Status update on the situation in Africa,"
he said, referring specifically to the Central African Republic.
"My directorate's assessment has been forwarded through the proper channels as requested. They will arrive on the desk you specified."
Alexander knew the desk in question was that of the foreign secretary and that the Bratva had already exerted the proper encouragement to sign the papers. In this case, it was €500,000 in a Swiss bank account and pictures of his grandchildren playing in this very park. The message was clear.
"Good."
The contract to extract uranium and diamonds from the CAR made the pittance paid to secure it well worth the small investment.
"Anything else?"
Alexander asked. Ivan paused. He wanted to ask about Medny Island. He wanted to ask about the rumors he'd since verified that his son was importing prisoners from Africa to hunt in the barrens of the Russian Far East. He wanted to ask his eldest son to join him at the family compound in the heart of Siberia. He wanted to know why his son had such hatred for him. Instead, he answered with a terse,
"Niet,
before ending the call. Alexander looked at what the American intelligence agencies called a burner phone in his hand. It was an unnecessary precaution. His connection to the Bratva was an open secret. In fact, it was the very reason for his rapid ascension through the ranks. One did not cross or insult the son of Bratva leadership and expect to be long for the world. He'd use the phone for the remainder of the month and then drop it into the Moskva River. His father was getting old. Old men make mistakes. Soon, Alexander would leave government service with enough information to blackmail half the Kremlin. That intelligence, coupled with the power of the world's most feared criminal organization, would see the Zharkov family influence solidified over Russian politics and business for another generation. It was his father's time to go. Chapter 24. Yak River Valley, Montana. The team had filtered in over the past few days, enforcers from Miami, Los Angeles, and Boston. Dmitri would have preferred that Ivan just hire a team of Wagner Group mercenaries to handle this, but he knew the CIA kept close tabs on those with Wagner affiliations trying to enter the United States. They split into two teams of six, one led by Dmitri and one by Vitya. To build unit cohesion, each team slept together, ate together, and trained together. A few of the men had military experience, but most did not. While Vitya performed his reconnaissance missions on the targets using the tools of his trade, Dmitri created a training schedule to turn these street thugs into something resembling soldiers. In the mornings, they ran and hiked the trails that surrounded the lake, heading up the relatively gradual incline hills behind the cabin and then into the steeper mountains beyond. These daily journeys ensured that they were all fit to move overland in this terrain and helped them acclimate to the altitude. They were all young and adapted quickly to the physical training. They would return to the barn each morning, shirtless and covered in sweat, their tattooed bodies on full display. Prison tattoos served like badges on a military uniform in the Brotherhood, with each crude ink design representing a significant crime or event. One could assess the experience of a gang member by their tattoos, the way a white-collar employer could read a resume. Dmitri had only served as a senior sergeant in the Russian army, but he wore the uniform of a World War II field marshal when it came to ink. After breakfast, Dmitri led them through the process of field stripping, inspecting, cleaning, and lubricating their rifles so that they would be intimately familiar with their operation. He built a makeshift firing range and personally guided each of the men through the process of zeroing their weapons. Each magazine was fully loaded and tested. Those that experienced stoppages made their way to the bottom of Okaga Lake. During the afternoon, they practiced small unit tactics. The team learned the basics of fire and maneuver, bounding overwatch, and spent hour upon hour practicing the effective L-shaped ambush. Dmitri taught them everything except how to retreat. In order to keep the gunfire to a minimum, the men carried unloaded weapons and used the age-old bang-bang method of simulating gunfire on the targets. After dinner, they were free to drink, smoke, and joke, bonding in the same manner that men have done under similar circumstances since the beginning of time. Many boasted about sexual conquests, either real or imagined. Tanya was a favorite topic. She was responsible for delivering groceries to the team on a semi-regular basis, and the men all looked forward to ogling her tight body when she came to call. Cell phones were not permitted, and other than the satellite television that seemed to always land on adult entertainment channels, she was their only link to the outside world. They trained 6 days per week and quickly began to act as a cohesive team. They would never stand a chance against a real military unit, but with the element of surprise on their side, they would get the job done. The key would be the target package, and Vitya was building a vivid intelligence picture on that front. Vitya watched the screen of the iPad, steering the drone to track the vehicle's progress below. The custom SUV was easy to spot, making target identification a simple process. He could hear the whine of its powerful engine as it climbed the hill. The driver eased off the accelerator as the vehicle crested the rise, moving almost silently as it approached the tight turn ahead. He was close enough to see the driver's bearded face as the Toyota rolled past, his attention diverted to something below, probably a phone or perhaps the stereo. The brakes engaged as the hairpin curve approached, and Vitya saw the red lights illuminated as the vehicle reached the corner. One couldn't take this blind turn at more than 30 miles per hour, and the thick copse of evergreens provided the ideal concealment that his team would need. That turn was where James Reese would die. Chapter 25. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Reese stood barefoot, staring out at the lake behind his cabin. The water was dead calm, without the slightest breeze to ripple its surface. He adjusted his feet on the soft carpet of short pine needles and squatted to grasp the thick handle of the 70-pound kettlebell before him. Exhaling sharply, he thrust his hips forward, driving the cast-iron weight to full extension, keeping his core muscles flexed as it floated briefly at the top of its arc. Gravity swung the bell downward, and he let it fall between his legs as he sucked a breath of air into his lungs. Up he came again, repeating the process until he'd done 10 perfect swings and set the weight back onto the ground. He dropped to his chest and executed 10 push-ups, then went back to the kettlebell, alternating reps until he'd performed 100 of each. His chest heaving and his shoulders searing with lactic acid, he picked up his bow and tried to get his breathing under control as he drew. His arms felt the let-off of tension as the cams engaged, and his eye found the green fiber optic sight pin through the rear peep entwined in the bow's taut string. The aperture of his vision blurred everything but the sight as his thumb found the cold aluminum of the release. He didn't fight the pin's movement but increased tension using his upper back muscles, transitioning that pressure naturally to his thumb, the sight picture settling into an ever-decreasing orbit at the target's center. The snap of the bowstring echoed in his ears as the carbon fiber arrow sped from 0 to 340 feet per second in an instant. His eyes did their best to track the arrow during its half-second flight, and his ears registered the hollow twock of its impact on the target. He drank water from a Nalgene bottle as he caught his breath and progressed to a series of Turkish get-ups, box jumps, shoulder presses, and goblet squats with kettlebells of various sizes. He alternated each section of his workout with a shot or two from his bow in preparation for a bugling elk at 30 yards. To prepare for just such a moment, Reese practiced shooting under the stress of a tough training regimen. His combined workout and archery session had lasted the better part of an hour. After a quick shower, he slipped on a pair of semi-clean jeans, a t-shirt, and trail running shoes. The compact 10mm Glock stayed in the chest rig for his trail runs, so he press-checked his SIG P320X compact and placed it in the holster behind his right hip. Be prepared. Rafe would be out watching his big muley buck at this time of day, so Reese skipped his shop visit and took the most direct route off the property. He was a few miles from the ranch's main gate on his way to town when his phone came alive. The hilltop was the first area with reliable cell service during his weekly trips to Whitefish, and inevitably alerts would sound as text messages were received. It was a clean cell phone, or as clean as one could get in the age of information. It was purchased through and registered to the Hastings' Land Management Company. The only people with the number were the Hastings clan, Vic Rodriguez at the CIA, and Katie Baranek. Most days he could expect a photo of her getting ready to go on a news segment or views from her workout running through the Washington Mall. It was their way of maintaining a long-distance friendship. Or was it something more? He glanced down at this morning's picture, Katie holding up a copy of John Avlon's book, Washington's Farewell. She'd managed to add a graphic to the photo saying, "You've got to read this. It's fantastic." Reese had no idea how to add graphics to a photo, but couldn't help but smile at the image. He'd have to stop by Bookworks in town and pick it up or have it ordered. He briefly wondered if he was becoming too predictable. He dropped his phone back in the cup holder and brought his attention back on the road as he approached the turn ahead. His grin faded as his thoughts returned to the present. If he were planning an ambush, he'd do it right here. After a lifetime of war, it was hard to turn off the primal side of the brain. Old habits die hard. Chapter 26. Yak River Valley, Montana. The hit team rose to their knees as the SUV rolled through the kill zone. Selector switches went to fully automatic, and nervous fingers quivered over triggers. The vehicle's forward progress slowed to a mere crawl, providing the perfect opportunity. Now! Vitya initiated the ambush with the explosive device, filling the kill zone with flying debris and dust. A second later, the entire team raked the vehicle with 7.62mm rounds, splintering glass, puncturing steel, and ripping through plastic as the bullets chewed through the SUV's exterior. The deafening roar of the fully automatic gunfire was brief, followed by the metallic chatter of a half dozen simultaneous magazine changes. A second volley of fire from the high ground raked the smoldering vehicle as the maneuver element moved down the embankment, opening up at close range as the support team's magazines ran dry. Vitya pushed toward the vehicle, his men firing as they went to ensure their primary target had no chance of survival. As their weapons all went dry, Vitya saw the youngest member of the team change magazines and run forward to the driver's side door. He stuck the muzzle of his AK through the shattered window and emptied all 30 rounds into a mannequin at knifing distance. That had not been part of the plan. Vitya would have to keep an eye on Oleg Guskov. Dmitri blew the whistle, ending the exercise. Though the men had fired live ammunition, the target vehicle had been a derelict Isuzu trooper towed on a long rope by the farm's John Deere tractor. The SUV was riddled with bullet holes, and the ambush had been a complete success. After weeks of training, rehearsals, equipment checks, and more rehearsals, the assassins were ready. Chapter 27. Glacier Park International Airport, Kalispell, Montana. Rhys looked up at the LCD monitor on the wall and back at his Resco dive watch. The flight from Minneapolis was running a few minutes late. You could probably get away with parking curbside at such a small airport, but Rhys had parked in the short-term lot, not wanting to get a ticket from a local cop looking to do his part in the global war on terror. He was dressed in what passed for formal attire by local standards, clean, cool pants and a half-zip. His beard was a bit shaggy, but all in all, he thought he looked presentable. He felt self-conscious, holding the bouquet of flowers, and shifted them nervously from one hand to the other, finally dangling them down his right leg like a drawn saber. Was he being too forward? Shit! He hadn't done this in a long time. The CRJ-900 regional jet seemed to move in slow motion as it taxied toward the jetway, finally releasing its passengers into the newly renovated terminal. Rhys waited as the plane's occupants passed out of the secure area of the terminal, a cowboy, a traveling salesman, an elderly couple. He finally saw her through the glass. Her blonde hair was pulled back into a ponytail, and she dragged her rollerboard suitcase, a copy of Brad Thor's Backlash tucked under her arm. Wives shot dirty looks at husbands who'd turned to look as she passed. Her face lit up when her eyes met Reese's, and he felt himself smile. It felt good. She laughed and stomped her feet as she drew near, letting go of her bag as she wrapped her arms around his neck. He kissed her cheek, and she took his face in both hands, turning his head for a quick peck on the lips, erasing any doubts about where their relationship was heading. "The mountains certainly agree with you," Katie said approvingly. "You look great." "You do too. You always do." "Stop," she said in mock embarrassment. She turned his head and ran her finger over the pinkish scar on his scalp where the neurosurgeons had done their work. "Barely noticeable." "Not too rough looking?" "Not by a long shot." Though I'm not sure what I think about this, she said, running her fingers across his beard. Looking a little gray, Mr. Rees. It's the mileage, he acknowledged with a raised eyebrow. Expecting someone special? Katie inquired, nodding her head toward the flowers. Rees suddenly became aware of the bouquet he'd picked up on the drive in. Oh, yeah. Sorry, these are for you. They're beautiful, Katie said, bringing them to her nose.
Thank you, James. So thoughtful.
Rees picked up her suitcase as they moved through the airport, his eyes subconsciously sweeping the area ahead. First hands, then bodies, then faces. The sixth sense that had kept warriors alive since time immemorial was reminding him that his peace could never last.
This is spectacular, Katie said, taking in the majesty of Montana.
Rees drove as they talked, steering the Land Cruiser up the Flathead Valley toward Kumba Ranch. I've always loved the mountains. I also need to keep a low profile for security reasons. I'm still processing the fallout from Odessa and from, well, you know.
I understand.
So, Katie said, changing subjects, what do we have in store for the weekend? Nothing too crazy. I'd love to show you around the ranch and do some hiking. Rafe and his family are dying to meet you.
Sounds great. I'm up for anything.
Ever fly fished?
I may have dabbled a bit, she said coyly.
What does that mean?
It's the one thing my dad enjoys almost as much as golf. He and his doctor buddies would do one big fly fishing trip a year. He started taking me and my brother out on weekends when we were kids.
I'm self-taught, so maybe you can give me some pointers.
I'd be happy to. I even brought my Winston four-weight.
What's a Winston?
Oh, James, I have so much to teach you.
You'll lose all cell service in a minute and probably won't have it again unless we come back to town. Do you need to make any calls? Rees slowed the SUV and navigated the tight turn that wound through the timber.
Nope, I'm all yours. No distractions.
She powered off her iPhone and dropped it into her purse, then feigned dusting off her hands to symbolize her release from the electronic leash. They caught up throughout the drive, Katie admiring the view and Rees pointing out various landmarks as he drove through the property. He paused the cruiser at the crest of the hill above his cabin to give them a commanding view of the lake, then steered down the track toward it.
Is this it?
Katie asked. This is it.
Wow, what a view!
Rees pulled the truck sideways in front of the cabin, and Katie was out before he could make it around to open the passenger door for her. She stood in the dirt driveway, admiring the home.
Incredible,
she said as Rees led the way to the front door, holding it open and stepping aside with a welcoming wave across the threshold. Katie stepped inside, taking in every detail. She walked to the center of the living room and looked upward to the vaulted ceiling. Rees stood silently just inside the door, waiting for a sign of approval. Well, what do you think? She looked almost teary-eyed as she faced him, her flushed face illuminating with a bright smile.
It's beautiful, James. I love it.
Can I get you something to drink? I have beer, wine, water. I can make coffee.
I'd love a beer. It's past 5 on the East Coast.
A woman after my own heart. Rees pulled 2 bottles of Wheatfish, a local lager, from the refrigerator and popped the caps using a bottle breacher from the kitchen drawer. He handed one to Katie and raised his own in a toast.
To new beginnings,
she helped, tapping the neck of his bottle with her own before taking a long pull without breaking eye contact. They walked through the French doors and out into the cabin's backyard, which essentially ran uninterrupted to Canada. Katie kicked off her boots and walked barefoot on the carpet of soft grass as Rees led her toward the water. The temperature was a perfect 71 degrees, and a cool breeze blew across the gin-clear lake, causing tiny waves to ripple softly against its bank. The lake's opposite shore was framed by mountains covered in towering emerald pines. High ground, an advantageous position, Rees found himself thinking.
This place looks like a screensaver, Katie remarked.
It really does, doesn't it?
I'm so happy to be here with you, James.
She turned to face him, looking up at him with a devilish grin.
Now would be a good time to kiss the girl.
Rhys didn't hesitate, leaning forward and taking her face in his hands. She wrapped her arms around his neck, drawing him back toward her and kissing him deeply. They both lost themselves completely in the moment. Rhys finally pulled back. Welcome to Montana. Chapter 28. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Katie showered while Rhys began to prepare dinner. He would introduce her to the Hastings family soon, but tonight it was just the two of them. The guest cabin had come with a Traeger grill, and Rhys had become very proficient in its use as he cooked his nightly meals lakeside, enjoying the age-old ritual of smoking wild game. With the smoker going out back, he worked diligently in the kitchen. He rubbed an elk tenderloin with a mixture of freshly chopped herbs and sliced the makings of a fresh salad, enjoying a glass of Tuck Beckstoffer's finest Pinot Noir as he prepared their meal. A stack of logs crackled in the large open fireplace, bathing the room in a flickering golden light. He heard the door open and looked up as Katie emerged. She was barefoot and her hair was down. She looked right at home in jeans and a flannel.
It feels so great to be out of D.C.
I'll bet, Rhys smiled.
Wine? Absolutely.
Holding the glass by its stem, she swirled it twice. She held it up to the last light of the Montana evening and took a moment to enjoy its aroma before taking a sip.
Is this a French Burgundy?
She asked, puzzled.
Actually, it's a Pinot Noir from the Sonoma coast. It's called Semper. I've always wanted to try that. I love the name. It isn't like any Pinot I've had before. It's tremendous.
The winemaker hunts with Rafe on the property. He always comes equipped with a few cases of his favorites. I liberated tonight's selections from Jonathan Hastings' wine cellar.
I knew those seal skills would come in handy. And what are you preparing to accompany such a splendid Vitis Vinifera?
The Pinot goes with the chips and salsa, Rhys smiled. For the main course of elk tenderloin, we'll switch it up.
Elk, is that what this is?
Katie asked, pointing to the mounted bull on the wall. It is. My dad shot that bull years ago.
Admittedly, I don't know much about hunting, though I did love the venison your dad would drop off as I was growing up.
How's your dad doing? Rhys asked.
For someone his age, he couldn't be better. He retired from his medical practice and plays a lot of golf. I think he's driving my mother crazy.
Good for him.
Can I help?
Katie asked. Nope, I've got it handled. You just relax and enjoy your wine.
So did you catch this thing?
Catch it?
Catch it, kill it, whatever you're supposed to say.
Ha! Well, you can say kill or harvest. I typically like to use both, as harvest sounds too much like you are picking corn, and kill doesn't convey to people that you are actually eating the meat. I was a little busy last fall, so this comes from Rafe's freezer. The Hastings clan has enough venison in their combined freezers to feed a small army.
It looks really lean.
It is. It's also good for you, about as organic and free range as you can get. You hungry?
Starving.
Good. Let's toss it on the grill. Rhys carried a platter outside, and Katie shivered as she watched him put the meat and sliced vegetables onto the charred steel grating. Gets cold here when the sun goes down, even in the summer, he said.
It's probably still 80 and humid in D.C.
Let's fix that, Rhys said, walking a few steps toward a stack of firewood and picking up a propane tank with a hose attached along with a Bic lighter. He opened the valve on the tank, and the fuel began to flow from the tubular attachment at the end of the hose. He sparked the lighter, and a foot-long flame erupted from the nozzle. He picked up the propane tank in one hand and held the nozzle in the other, walking toward the stone fire ring that sat between the Adirondack chairs. The nozzle bathed the stack of split logs in fire, starting them ablaze almost instantly. He worked the flame back and forth until he was satisfied before closing the tank's valve.
What is that thing, a flamethrower?
Montana fire starter. Come get warm. They sat together, sipping wine as their dinner cooked nearby, staring into the open flames as the last light of day slipped away. Even with Katie by his side, Rhys couldn't help but think that halfway around the world, teams of special operators were just returning to base after hitting a target. He knew the only time most would hear or think about them was if something went wrong and it was reported on the news. They'd be returning sweaty, dusty, possibly bloody. They'd turn over any enemy detainees to the proper authorities, top off magazines, replace batteries in IR lasers and flashlights, and get ready to do it all over again tomorrow. Those men and women on the front lines provided the blanket of freedom that allowed Rhys and Katie to enjoy this evening by the lake. Rhys would never forget that they were out there. Not long ago, he had been one of them. He'd never witness another sunset without thinking of them and sending a silent prayer their way. In response to Katie's questioning look, Rhys glanced at his watch and jumped up to attend to the cooking. He flipped the tenderloin and took the vegetables off the fire to cool, standing vigil over the grill for the last few minutes that the elk needed to complete the outside sear. He probed the meat with his knuckle and, satisfied, pulled it from the fire. "Let's go inside. Almost ready." As the meat rested, Katie found a candle in one of the kitchen drawers and placed it next to the bouquet that she'd put in a vase on the table. Rhys added a light dressing to the salad and tossed it with two large forks, placing a portion on each of their plates. He flanked the salad with slices of grilled squash and zucchini and drizzled them with balsamic vinegar. Finally, he sliced the tenderloin into half-inch sections, inspecting the meat as he cut. The outside was charred, and the center was a warm, red, medium rare. Perfect.
"This looks amazing. I didn't know you could cook."
"I'll be out of recipes in 2 days. I didn't want to burden Rafe's family with feeding me, and there's obviously no restaurant nearby, so I've been doing a lot of grilling. I don't think I've ever turned the oven on."
"Then grilling it is."
"Are you ready for the next pairing?" Rhys asked as he set their plates on the rustic farm table.
"You know I am. What has Jonathan Hastings' wine cellar produced for us next, this evening?"
Rhys held up the bottle next to a glass decanter. "It's named for To Kill a Mockingbird."
"One of my favorite novels of all time," Katie declared.
"Mine too." Katie opened cupboards until she found what she was looking for.
"For a wine especial as Mockingbird Blue, we need the right glass," she said, pulling two large Bordeaux glasses from the shelf.
Tuck Beckstoffer's famed Cabernet had been breathing in a decanter since Rhys started preparing dinner. He gave them both a healthy pour as they sat down to eat. "Cheers," Rhys said, as they clinked glasses. Katie swirled the wine and held it to the candlelight, admiring its legs. She then closed her eyes and breathed in its aroma through her nose before taking her first sip.
"What an elegant red," she noted. "Great balance for such a full-bodied cab. How do you know so much about wines?" "My little secret is that I didn't start out to be a journalist."
"Really?"
"I did 2 years in the viticulture and enology undergrad program at UC Davis."
"I'll have to look both those words up next time I get cell service."
"Let me help you. Viticulture refers to growing grapes, from the Latin word for vine, and enology is the science of winemaking."
"What made you switch?"
"Honestly," Katie said, "the war. My dad, your dad. I felt like this country had provided my family so much opportunity. Seeing those freedoms squandered and eroded by pandering career politicians while young men and women who stood up to volunteer to defend the nation kept coming home in caskets made me angry. When Ambassador Stevens, Sean Smith, and your friends Ty Woods and Glenn Doherty were killed in Benghazi, I knew I had to do something. Politicians left them to die. Politicians who would never be held accountable. So I transferred to English at Berkeley and then went to Columbia School of Journalism for my master's. That's where I started work on the Benghazi betrayal." She paused. "Sorry to get so serious."
"In vino veritas," Rhys said, bringing the red wine to his lips.
"In wine lies the truth. I knew I liked you, Mr. Rhys."
"What do you think of the elk?"
"It's delicious. I could eat this every night."
"That's good, because it's about all we really have available," the former frogman said with a wink.
"It's so peaceful, Rhys. I can see why you came here."
"This feels like home." I felt this way in Mozambique until they found me.
What did you think about when you were in Africa? Katie wondered aloud.
Ah, a lot of things, I guess. I went to Mozambique to die and ended up learning to live again. I found purpose out there, using my old skills to counter the poachers. I thought about my family, and I thought a lot about the people who had helped me in the U.S. after Lauren and Lucy were killed. I wondered if I'd put them in danger or if the government was going to figure out who had assisted and take legal action against them. Katie nodded and gazed into her glass. And, Rhys continued, I thought about you.
You did?
That might have been the only thing that kept me alive. This sounds strange, but even though I thought I was dying, thinking of you gave me hope. Katie swallowed, her eyes misting over as she thought of all he'd been through.
I thought of you too, James. It drove me crazy, not knowing if you were dead or alive.
I'd been living for so long thinking I was a dead man, I didn't know how to live, believing I had a future.
And now?
And now I'm figuring out that future. Katie took a breath.
Well, this is certainly a good place to do it,
she said, looking around the spacious lakefront cabin. I think so, Rhys confirmed. Now on to more important topics, like if there is any more Mockingbird Blue? Katie asked, holding up her empty glass. Katie moved to the living area as Rhys refilled their glasses from the decanter in the kitchen. She sat on the couch, her legs pulled beneath her. Rhys carefully handed her the wine before taking a seat, her knee lightly touching his thigh. They were both aware of the contact, and neither made an effort to move.
Are you going to go back to work for them?
She didn't have to specify whom she meant by them.
Possibly.
I'm connected as a contractor right now. There's something I need to do, and they might be the only ones who can help. Rhys didn't offer more, and Katie didn't push, instead asking,
When you got quiet out by the fire, what were you thinking about?
Rhys paused. What I always think about when the sun sets. That somewhere the enemy is out there, planning, getting ready to hit us again. And that there are a select few getting ready to take the fight to them.
Do you feel guilty that you are not with them?
She was extremely perceptive. From a woman's intuition or a journalist's savvy, Rhys wasn't sure. Not really guilt. It's more like I feel a responsibility to keep fighting. She put her hand on his.
You're safe here, James. Take some time. I'm here to help.
They each took long sips of wine and stared into the fireplace. Rhys broke the silence first.
I don't know how safe it is.
What happened in Odessa? It's not over.
Let me face it with you, James.
She was brave. Rhys felt choked up as he remembered her black and blue face, blood trickling from her nose, neck wrapped in explosives, looking up at him with pure terror in her eyes. Katie, I knew that debt cord wouldn't blow. Katie's blue eyes connected with his of piercing brown.
I know.
They kissed one another breathlessly, each of their hands caressing, exploring. Katie rose without another word. Taking Rhys by the hand, she pulled him to his feet and led him to the bedroom. Chapter 29. St. Petersburg, Russia. Gray was living in his office, monitoring events in Montana as best he could without making direct contact with the team on the ground. Tanya, the female asset sent in from New York, was making her daily social media posts. These seemingly innocuous ramblings and photographs, mere cells in the entire biosphere of web traffic, were a direct signal to Gray that the ground team was on track. Since Rhys's movements were never exact, especially given the holiday weekend, the team had moved into position and would remain in place until he appeared. As soon as the secondary team received word that Rhys was down, they would move in on Rafe Hastings and finish the job. Accounting for daylight savings time, there was a 9-hour time difference between local time in Russia and Montana. 8 a.m. local at the target was 5 o'clock p.m. for Gray, which meant that late nights were part of the program. It was approaching 10 o'clock p.m. now, and he had been in the office for more than 14 hours. His freshly laundered dress shirt was wrinkled, his tie was loose, and his jacket was hanging in its usual spot on his office door. For Gray, the monotonous hours of waiting for a subject to move was nothing new, but given his personal connection to this target, that experience didn't make this wait easier. He grabbed a pint of good local vodka from his desk drawer and took a long pull before pouring a splash into the tea that Svetlana had delivered to him before she left for the evening. The target vehicle had moved on Thursday, making a stop at the airport in Kalispell, no doubt picking someone up for the weekend.
The reporter?
Maybe that explained why he hadn't left his cabin this morning, despite the late hour. Sooner or later, he would have to go to town, and when he did, the hit team would be waiting. Chapter 30. Flathead Valley, Montana. Vitya stared at the screen of the tablet, trying to will the blinking light that represented the target vehicle to move. But there it sat in front of the lakefront cabin. He and his team had hiked to the high ground above the ambush site the previous afternoon, setting up camp 300 yards from the road in the dense forest. The GPS tracker would give him at least 30 minutes' notice that the target was on its way, which was plenty of time for them to set the trap. For now, they rested in shifts, fiddled with their weapons, ate salty, dehydrated meals out of plastic bags, and drank enough coffee to give them all atrial fibrillations. Vitya's team was tasked with killing James Reese. He was the primary target and would be eliminated first. Then the second team would kill Rafe Hastings. He walked down to the ambush position for the 20th time and surveyed the scene. The IED was positioned at just the right angle to rake the road with its 700 3.2 mm steel ball bearings, which would shred everything in their path at 1,200 meters per second. The convex mine was concealed under a bed of pine straw at the base of a tree. Its wire was buried along the path. Vitya carried a green plastic firing device in his jacket pocket. He'd used the M40 test set included with the mine to confirm that it was working properly and would send the electric pulse necessary to power the blasting cap and fire the mine's plastic explosive. He couldn't risk a premature explosion, so he would only connect the detonator when he had confirmation that the target was on his way. It would be a shame if the bait was caught in the powerful blast. He hadn't even had a chance to sample the goods, but that couldn't be helped. Every battle had collateral damage. He looked down at the AKM slung at his side. It was spray-painted in a green and brown camouflage pattern to eliminate the glossy shine that had burnished through the original finish by years of rough use. After spending the preceding weeks with the iconic weapon, he had become interested in its origin and often wondered about the stories it could tell. Its stamped steel receiver differentiated it from a true AK-47, though that name would forever be associated with Kalashnikov's deadly design. He saw the arrow in triangle proof mark of the Ijevsk Armory, the small arms factory turned machine-building plant that had armed Russia's fighting men and women with everything from muskets to machine guns since the early 19th century. Behind the arsenal mark was the year the rifle was built, 1975. Vitya was younger than his weapon. The name Ricardo had been carved into the wooden buttstock by one of its previous users, trench art from the latter days of a Cold War battlefield now relegated to the pages of history. Ricardo was probably a Sandinista, given the weapon's Central American pedigree, but due to the widespread distribution of Russian weapons, Vitya couldn't be sure.
Was Ricardo waiting to ambush a group of CIA-backed Contras when
Boredom took over and he decided to carve his name into his weapon. Had Ricardo survived?
Vitia would never know. Chapter 31. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Rhys awoke early, his body unaccustomed to the warmth of someone else in his bed. He didn't move, not wanting to disturb Katie's sleep as she lay on her side next to him. She looked peaceful, her face content, the rhythmic rising and falling of her bare shoulder the only movement. He watched her for an eternity in the semi-darkness, taking in every detail. A tiny gold cross hung askew around her neck on a wire-thin chain. Rhys felt a sense of harmony that he hadn't known since his family was taken from him. As the sun shone,